sneaking a healer in? Who would risk the commandant's wrath to save a slave's life, even for a fat purse? Does she still live? Maybe her injuries weren't as bad as I thought. Maybe Cook can heal her. Maybe cats can fly, Elias. I'm mashing my food to a pulp when Helene walks into the crowded mess hall. I'm startled at the sloppiness of her hair and the pink shadows beneath her eyes. She spots me and approaches. I stiffen and shove a spoonful of food into my mouth, refusing to look at her.
The slave is feeling better.
She lowers her voice so the students around us can't hear.
I stopped by there. She got through the night.
Is she going to apologize? After refusing to help an innocent girl who hadn't done anything wrong, except be born a scholar instead of a marshal.
Better, is she?
I say.
I'm sure you're thrilled.
I get up and walk away. Helene is stone still behind me, as stunned as if I've punched her, and I feel a savage flood of satisfaction.
That's right, Aquila. I'm not like you. I'm not going to forget her just because she's a slave.
I send a silent thanks to Cook. If Lya survived, it's no doubt due to the older woman's ministrations. Should I visit the girl? What will I say?
Sorry Marcus nearly raped and killed you. Heard you're feeling better, though.
I can't visit her. She won't want to see me anyway. I'm a mask. If she hates me for that alone, it's reason enough. But maybe I can stop by the house. Cook can tell me how Lya's doing. I can take something for her, something small. Flowers? I look around the school grounds. Blackcliff doesn't have flowers. Maybe I'll give her a dagger. There are plenty of those around, and Skies know she needs one.
Elias!
Helene has followed me out of the mess hall, but the fog helps me evade her. I duck into a training building, watching from a window until she gives up and goes on her way. See how she likes the silent treatment. A few minutes later, I find myself heading to the commandant's house.
Just a quick visit, just to see if she's all right.
Your mother hears about this. She'll skin you alive,
Cook says from the kitchen door when I slip into the servants' corridor.
And the rest of us, too, for letting you in here.
Is she all right?
She's not dead. Go on, aspirant. Leave. I'm not joking about the commandant.
If a slave spoke like that to Demetrius or Dex, they'd backhand her. But Cook is only doing what she thinks is best for Lya. I do as she asks. The rest of the day is a blur of failed combat battles, curt conversations, and narrow escapes from Helene. The mist gets so thick I can barely see my hand in front of my face, making training more grueling than usual. When the curfew drums beat, all I want is sleep. I head to the barracks, dead on my feet, when Hel catches up to me.
How was training?
She appears out of the mist silently as a wraith, and despite myself, I jump.
Splendid,
I say darkly. Of course it wasn't splendid, and Helene knows it. I haven't fought so poorly in years. What little focus I recovered during last night's battles with Hel is gone.
Faris said you missed sim practice this morning. Said he saw you walking to the commandant's house.
You and Faris gossip like schoolgirls.
Did you see the girl?
Cook didn't let me in. And the girl has a name. It's Lya.
Elias, it could never work out between you two.
My answering laugh echoes weirdly in the mist.
What kind of idiot do you take me for? Of course it couldn't work. I only wanted to find out if she was all right. So what?
So what?
Helene grabs my arm and yanks me to a halt.
You're an aspirant. You have a trial to take tomorrow. Your life will be on the line, and instead you're mooning over some scholar.
My hackles rise. She senses it and takes a breath.
All I'm saying is that there are more important things to think about. The Emperor will be here in days, and he wants us all dead. The Commandant doesn't seem to know, or care. And I have a bad feeling about the third trial, Elias. We have to hope that Marcus gets eliminated. He can't win, Elias. He can't. If he does...
I know, Helene. I've staked every hope I have on these damned trials. Trust me, I know. 10 hells. I liked her better when she wasn't speaking to me.
If you know, then why are you letting yourself get destroyed in combat? How can you win the trial if you don't have the confidence to defeat someone like Zack? Don't you understand what's at stake?
Of course I do.
But you don't! Look at you! You're too befuddled by that slave girl.
It's not her that's befuddling me, all right? It's a million other things. It's this place and what we do here. It's you.
Me?
She looks bewildered, and that makes me angrier.
What did I do?
You're in love with me! I shout at her now because I'm so angry at her for loving me, even though the logical part of me knows that I'm being cruelly unfair. But I'm not in love with you, and you hate me for it. You've let that ruin our friendship. She just stares, the wound in her eyes raw and growing. Why did she have to fall for me? If she had controlled her emotions, we never would have fought the night of the Moon Festival. We would have spent the last 10 days planning for the third trial, instead of avoiding each other. You're in love with me, I say again. But I could never be in love with you, Helene. Never. You're just like every other mask. You were willing to let Lyra die just because she's a slave.
I didn't let her die.
Helene's voice is quiet.
I went to her last night, and I healed her. That's why she's alive. I sang to her, sang until my voice was gone and I felt like I'd had the life sucked out of me. Sang until she was well again.
You healed her? But...
What? You don't believe I could do something kind for another human? I'm not evil, Elias. No matter what you say.
I never said...
But you did!
Her voice rises.
You just said I'm like every other mask. You just said you could never... Never love...
She spins away from me, but after only a few steps, turns back. Trails of mist sweep out behind her like a ghostly dress.
You think I want to feel this way about you? I... Hate it, Elias. Watching you flirt with illustrian girls and sleep with scholar slaves and find the good in everyone. Everyone. But me.
A sob escapes her. The only time I've ever heard her cry. She chokes it back.
Loving you is the worst thing that has ever happened to me. Worse than the Commandant's whippings. Worse than the trials. It's torture, Elias.
She digs a shaking hand into her hair.
You don't know what it's like. You have no idea what I've given up for you. The deal I made.
What do you mean? I say. What deal? With who? For what? She doesn't answer. She's walking, running away from me. Helene! I chase after her, my fingers brushing the wetness of her face for one tantalizing second. Then the mist swallows her up, and she's gone.
Chapter 37 Liar.
Get her up, damn you! The Commandant's orders cut through the fog of my brain, startling me from sleep. I didn't pay 200 marks so she could sleep all day.
My mind is like tar, my body racked with dull pain, but I'm aware enough to know that if I don't rise from this pallet, I really am dead. As I grab a cloak, Izzy pushes the curtain to my room aside.
You're awake!
She's obviously relieved.
Commandant's on the warpath!
What day is it? I shiver. It's cold, far colder than is normal for summer. I have a sudden fear that I've been unconscious for weeks, that the trials are over, that Darren is dead.
Marcus attacked you last night, Izzy says. Aspirant Aquila.
Her eyes wide, and I know then that I didn't dream the aspirant's presence, or the fact that she healed me. Magic. I find myself smiling at the thought. Darren would laugh, but there's no other explanation. And after all, if ghouls and djinn walk our world, then why not forces of good too? Why not a girl who can heal with a song?
Can you stand? Izzy says. It's past noon. I took care of your morning chores, and I'd do the others, but the Commandant's quite insistent that you...
Past noon? The smile drops from my face.
Skies, Izzy. I had a meeting with the Resistance 2 hours ago. I have to tell them about the tunnel. Keenan might still be waiting.
Liar, the Commandant sealed up the tunnel.
No. No.
That tunnel is the only thing that stands between Darin and death.
She questioned Marcus last night after Veturius brought you in,
Izzy says miserably.
He must have told her about the tunnel. Because when I went by it this morning, the Legionnaires were bricking it closed.
Did she question you? Izzy nods.
And Cook too. Marcus told the Commandant that you and I were spying on him, but I... Well,
she fidgets and looks over her shoulder.
I lied.
You lied? For me?
Skies, when the Commandant finds out, she'll kill Izzy.
No, liar, I tell myself. Izzy won't die, because you'll find a way to get her out of here before it comes to that.
What did you say to her?
I ask.
Told her that Cook sent us to get Crowley from the storage room by the barracks, and that Marcus waylaid us on the way back.
And she believed you, over a mask. Izzy shrugs.
I've never lied to her before, she says.
And Cook backed up my story, said she was having horrible back pain, and that Crowleaf was the only thing that would help.
Marcus called me a liar, but then the Commandant sent for Zack, and he admitted there was a chance that he'd left the tunnel entrance open, and that we just happened to pass by.
Commandant, let me go after that. Izzy looks at me worriedly.
Liar, what are you going to tell Mazin?
I shake my head. I have no idea. Cook sends me into the city with a stack of letters for the courier without so much as a mention of the beating I took.
Be quick about it,
the old woman says when I appear in the kitchen to resume my duties.
There's a nasty storm coming, and I need you and kitchen girl to board up the windows before they're blown out.
The city is strangely quiet, its cobbled lanes emptier than usual, its spires shrouded in unseasonable fog. The smells of bread and beast, smoke and steel are dulled, as if the mist has weakened their potency. Conscious of my freshly healed limbs, I move gingerly. But even after a half hour of walking, all that remains of the beating I took are ugly bruises and a dull soreness. I head first to the courier's office in Execution Square, hoping that the Resistance is still waiting for me. The rebels don't disappoint. Within seconds of entering the square, I smell cedarwood. Moments later, Keenan materializes out of the fog.
This way.
He says nothing of my injuries, and I'm stung by his lack of concern. Just as I'm willing myself not to care, he takes my hand as if it's the most natural thing in the world, and leads me to the back room of a cramped, abandoned shoe shop. Keenan sets spark to a lamp hanging on the wall, and as the light flares, He turns and looks me full in the face. The aloofness drops. For a second, he's unveiled, and I know with lightning certainty that behind that coolness he feels something for me. His eyes are almost black as he takes in every bruise. "Who did this?" he asks. "An aspirant. It's why I missed the meeting. I'm sorry." "Why are you apologizing?" He is incredulous. "Look at you. Look what they've done to you. Skies, if your father was alive and knew I let this happen..." "You didn't let it happen." I put a hand on his arm, surprised at the tautness of his body, like a wolf raring for a fight. "It's no one's fault but the mask who did it. And I'm better now." "You don't have to be brave, liar." His words are spoken with a quiet fierceness, and I suddenly feel shy of him. He raises his hand slowly, tracing my eyes, my lips, the curve of my neck with the tip of his finger. "I've been thinking about you for days." He puts his warm hand against my face, and I want so much to lean into it, hoping I'd see you in the square, wearing a grey scarf, so this can all be over, so that you can get your brother back. And after, we could... you and I could..." He trails off. My breath comes in short, shallow bursts, and my skin tingles in wild impatience. He moves closer, drawing up my gaze, pinning me with his eyes. Oh, Skies. He's going to kiss me. Then, bizarrely, he steps away from me. His eyes are guarded again, his face empty of any emotion but a sort of professional detachment. My skin burns in embarrassment at the rejection. A second later, I understand. "There she is," a gruff voice sounds from the door, and Mazin enters the room. I look to Keenan, but he appears almost bored, and I'm shaken at how his eyes can go cold as quickly as a candle being blown out. "He's a fighter," a practical voice chides me. "He knows what's important. As should you. Focus on Darin."
"We miss you this morning, liar."
Mazin takes in my injuries.
"Now I see why. Well, girl, do you have what I want? Do you have an entrance?"
"I have something." The lie takes me by surprise, as does the smoothness with which I tell it. "But I need more time." Surprise flashes across Mazin's face for a brief, naked second. Is it my lie that's caught him off guard? My request for more time? Neither, my instinct tells me. Something else. I fidget as I remember what Cook said days ago. "You ask him where exactly your brother is in Central Prison. What cell?" I muster my courage. I have a question for you. You know where Darin is, right? Which prison? Which cell?
Of course I know where he is. If I didn't, I wouldn't be spending all my time and energy figuring out how to free him, now would I?
But, well, Central is so heavily guarded. How will you...
Do you have a way into Blackcliff or not?
Why do you need one? I burst out. He's not answering my questions, and some stubborn part of me wants to shake the answers loose from him. How will a secret entrance to Blackcliff help you free my brother from the most fortified prison in the South? Mazin's gaze hardens from wariness to something close to anger.
"Darin's not in Central," he says. "Before the Moon Festival, the marshals moved him to the death cells in Bekhar Prison. Bekhar provides backup guard to Blackcliff. So when we launch a surprise attack on Blackcliff with half of our forces, the soldiers will pour out of Bekhar to Blackcliff, leaving the prison open for our other forces to take."
"Oh." I fall silent. Bekhar is a small prison in the Illustrian Quarter, not too far from Blackcliff. But that's all I know about it. Mazin's plan makes sense now. Perfect sense. I feel like an idiot.
"I didn't mention anything to you, or anyone else."
He looks pointedly at Keenan.
"Because the more people who know about a plan, the more likely it is to be compromised. So, for the last time, do you have something for me.
There's a tunnel. By time, say anything. But I have to figure out where it lets out.
That's not enough, Mazin says. If you have nothing, then this mission is a failure.
Sir! The door pounds open, and Sana tumbles in. She looks as if she hasn't slept in days, and she doesn't share the smug smiles of the two men behind her. When she sees me, she does a double take.
Liar! Your face!
Her eyes drop to my scar.
What happened? Sana, Mazin barks. Report!
Sana snaps her attention to the resistance leader.
It's time, she says. If we're going to do it, then we need to leave. Now!
Time for what? I look at Mazin, thinking he'll tell them to wait a moment, that he'll finish with me. But instead, he limps to the door, as if I've ceased to exist.
Sana and Keenan exchange a glance,
and Sana shakes her head, as if in warning. Keenan ignores her.
Mazin, he says. What about Lyre?
Mazin stops to consider me, the annoyance on his face ill-concealed.
You need more time, he says. You have it. Get me something by midnight, day after tomorrow. Then we'll get your brother out, and this whole thing will be over.
He walks out, engaged in low conversation with his men, snapping at Sana to follow. The older woman gives Keenan an unreadable look before hurrying out.
I don't understand, I say. A minute ago, he said we were done.
Something's not right.
Keenan stares hard at the door. And I need to find out what it is.
Will he keep his promise, Keenan? To free Darin?
Sana's faction's been pushing him. They think he should have broken Darin out already. They won't let him back away from this, but...
He shakes his head.
I have to go. Be safe, Liar.
Outside, the fog is so heavy that I have to put my hands in front of me to keep from running into anything. It's the middle of the afternoon, but the sky grows darker by the second. A thick bank of clouds roils above Sarah, as if gathering strength for an assault. As I head back to Blackcliff, I try to make sense of what just happened. I want to believe that I can trust Mazin, that he'll hold to his end of the bargain. But something is off. I've struggled for days to eke out extra time from him. It makes no sense for him to suddenly give it away so easily. And something else sets my nerves on edge. It's how quickly Mazin forgot about me when Sana showed up. And it's how, when he promised to save my brother, he didn't quite look me in the eyes.
Chapter 38 Elias. On the morning of the trial of strength, a bone-shaking rumble of thunder jerks me from sleep, and I lay in the darkness of my quarters for a long time, listening to the rain drop the barracks roof. Someone slips a parchment marked with the augur's diamond seal beneath my door. I rip it open. Fatigues only. Battle armor is forbidden. Remain in your room. I will come for you. Cain. A quiet scratching comes at the door as I crumple the note. A terrified-looking slave boy stands outside, offering a tray of lumpy gruel and hard flatbread. I force myself to shovel down every bite. As disgusting as it is, I need all the fuel I can get if I'm going to win in combat. I strap on my weapons, both Telemann Sims across my back, a brace of daggers across my chest, and one knife tucked into each boot. Then I wait. The hours inch by, slower than a graveyard shift on the watchtowers. Outside, the wind rages, sending branches and leaves tumbling past my window. I wonder if Helene is in her room. Has Cain come for her already? Finally, in the late afternoon, a knock comes at my door. I'm so charged I want to rip down the walls with my bare hands. Aspirant Veturius, Cain says when I open the door. It is time. Outside, the cold takes my breath away, cutting through my thin clothes like an icy scythe. It feels as if I'm wearing nothing at all. Sarah is never this cold in the summer. It's hardly ever this cold in the winter. I look sideways at Cain. The weather must be his doing, his and his ilk. The thought darkens my mood. Is there anything they can't do?
Yes, Elias.
Cain answers my question.
We cannot die.
The hilts of my sims knock against my neck, cold as ice, and despite the all-weather boots, my feet are numb. I follow Cain closely, unable to make heads or tails of our direction, until the high, arched walls of the amphitheater rise up in front of us. We duck into the amphitheater's armory, which is packed with men in red leather practice armor. I wipe the rain from my eyes and stare in disbelief. Red platoon! Dex and Faris are there, along with the other 27 men in my battle platoon, including Cyril, a barrel-shaped boy who hates taking orders, but accepts mine readily, and Darian, who has fists like hammers. I should find comfort in knowing these men will back me up in the trial, but instead, I'm jumpy. What does Cain have planned for us? Cyril holds out my practice armor.
All present and accounted for, Commander, Dex says.
He looks straight ahead, but his voice betrays his nerves. As I buckle on the armor, I take in the mood of the platoon. Tension radiates off them, but that's understandable. They know the details of the first two trials. They must be wondering what augur-conjured horror they'll have to face.
In a few moments, Cain says, you will exit this armory and find yourself on the amphitheater field. There, you will engage in a battle to the death. Battle armor is forbidden and has already been taken from you. Your goal is simple. You are to kill as many of the enemy as you can. The battle will end when you, Aspirant Veturius, defeat, or are defeated by, the leader of the enemy. I warn you now, if you show mercy, if you hesitate to kill, there will be consequences.
Right. Like having our throats ripped open by whatever is waiting for us out there.
Are you ready?
Cain asks. A battle to the death. That means some of my men, my friends, might die today. Dex meets my eyes briefly. He has the look of a trapped man, a man with a gnawing secret. He flicks a fearful glance at Cain and lowers his gaze. That's when I notice Faris's hands trembling. Beside him, Cyril toys anxiously with a dagger, rubbing its edge against his finger. Darian stares at me strangely. What is that in his eyes? Sadness? Fear? Some dark knowledge haunts my men, something they aren't willing to tell me. Has Cain given them cause to doubt victory? I glare at the augur. Doubt and fear are treacherous emotions before a fight. Together, they can infiltrate the minds of good men and decide a battle before it's begun. I eye the door to the theater's field. Whatever's waiting for us out there, we'll have to be equal to it, or we'll die. We're ready. The door opens, and at Cain's nod, I lead the platoon out. The rain is mixed with sleet, and my hands tingle and grow stiff. The bellow of thunder and slap of rain on mud muffles the sound of our passage. The enemy won't hear us coming, but we won't hear them either.
Split!
I shout to Dex, knowing he'll barely be able to make out my words over the storm.
You cover left flank! If you find the enemy, report back to me! Do not engage!
but for the first time since he became my lieutenant, Dex doesn't acknowledge my orders. He doesn't move. He stares over my shoulder into the mist obscuring the battlefield. I follow his gaze, and movement catches my eye. Leather armor, the flash of a sim. Has one of my men slipped ahead for recon? No. I do a quick head count, and they are all arrayed behind me, awaiting orders. Lightning splits the sky, illuminating the battlefield for a tantalizing moment. Then the mist descends, thick as a blanket. But not before I see whom we're fighting. Not before shock turns my blood to ice and my body to stone. I find Dex's eyes. The truth is there, in his pale, haunted gaze, and in Farris's and Cyril's. In every man's. They know. At that moment, a blue-clad figure flies with familiar grace out of the mists, silver braid shining, descending upon Red Platoon like a falling star. Then she sees me and falters, eyes widening.
Elias!
Strength of arms and mind and heart. For this, to kill my best friend, to kill her platoon. Commander! Dex grabs me. Orders! Helene's men emerge from the mist, sims out and ready. Demetrius, Leander, Tristus, Ennis. I know these men. I grew to adulthood with them, suffered with them, sweated with them. I won't give the order to kill them. Dex shakes me. Orders, Veturius! We need orders! Orders. Of course. I'm Red Platoon's commander. It's up to me to decide.
If you show mercy, if you do not kill your enemy, there will be consequences.
Strike to injure only! I shout.
Damn the consequences.
Do not kill! Do not kill! I barely have time to give the order before Blue Platoon is on us, fighting as viciously as if we're a tribe of border raiders. I hear Helene scream something, but I can't make it out in the cacophony of pounding rain and clashing swords. She disappears, lost in the chaos. I turn to look for her, and spot Tristus cutting through the melee, coming straight for me. He slings a saw-toothed dagger at my chest, and I only just deflected with my sim. He reaches for his own sim and rushes me. I drop, letting him roll over me before bringing the blunt end of my blade to the back of his legs. He loses his footing and slips into the thickening mud, landing on his back with throat exposed, open for the kill. I turn away, waiting to disarm my next foe. But as I do, Farris, who has gained the upper hand in a fight with another of Helene's men, starts to shake. His eyes bulge. The spear he holds falls from his nerveless fingers, and his face turns blue. His opponent, a quiet boy named Fortis, wipes sleet from his eyes and stares, open-mouthed, as Farris collapses to his knees, clawing at an enemy no one else can see. What is happening to him? I rush forward, my mind screaming at me to do something. But as soon as I get within a foot of him, my body is flung back as if by an unseen hand. My vision goes black for a moment, but I scrabble to my feet anyway, hoping none of my foes will choose this moment to attack. What is this? What's happening to Farris? Tristus staggers up from where I left him, his face lit with frightening intensity as he finds me. He means to end my life. Farris's chokes fade. He's dying. Consequences. There will be consequences. Time shifts. The seconds stretch, each as long as an hour, as I gaze at the mayhem of the battlefield. Red Platoon follows my orders to injure only, and we are suffering for it.
Cyril is down. So is Darian. Every time one of my men shows mercy to the enemy, one of their comrades falls. Their life wrung out of them by augur devilry.
Consequences.
I look between Faris and Tristus. They came to Blackcliff when Helene and I did. Tristus, dark-haired and wide-eyed, covered in bruises from the brutality of initiation. Faris, starved and peaked, no hint of the humour and brawn he'd possess later in life. Helene and I befriended them in our first week, all of us defending each other as best as we could against our predatory classmates. And now one of them will die, no matter what I do. Tristus comes for me, tears streaking his mask. His black hair is covered in mud, and his eyes burn with the panic of a cornered animal as he looks between Faris and me.
I'm sorry, Elias.
He takes a step toward me, and suddenly his body stiffens. The sim in his hand tips into the mud as he peers down at the blade emerging from his chest. Then he slides to the wet ground, his gaze fixed on me. Dex stands behind him, revulsion bursting from his eyes as he watches one of his best friends die by his hand.
No, not Tristus.
Tristus, who's been engaged to his childhood sweetheart since he was 17, who helped me understand Helene, who has four sisters who adore him. I stare at his body, at the tattoo on his arm. Aelia. Tristus, dead.
Dead.
Faris stops struggling. He coughs and stands shakily, then looks down at Tristus's body with dawning shock. But he has as little time to grieve as I do. One of Helene's men sends a mace whistling toward his head, and he is soon locked in another battle, jabbing and lunging as if he hadn't been perched on the edge of the abyss a minute before. Dex is in my face then, his eyes wild.
We have to kill them! Give the order!
My mind won't think the words. My lips won't speak them. I know these men. And Helene. I can't let them kill Helene. I think of the nightmare battlefield, Demetrius and Leander and Ennis. No, no, no. Around me, my men drop, suffocating as they refuse to kill their friends, or falling beneath the merciless blades of Blue Platoon.
Darian's dead, Elias!
Dex shakes me again.
Cyril, too! Aquila gave the order already! You have to give it too, or we're done for! Elias!
He forces me to meet his eyes.
Please!
Unable to speak, I raise my hands and give the signal, my skin crawling as word passes down the battlefield from soldier to soldier. Red Commander's orders. Fight to kill. No quarter. There is no cursing, no yelling, no bluffing. We are, all of us, trapped in a pocket of unending violence. Swords grinding and friends dying and the sleet knifing down on us. I've given the order, and so I take the lead. I show no hesitation, because if I do, my men will falter. And if they falter, we all die. So I kill. Blood taints everything. My armor, my skin, my mask, my hair. The hilt of my sim drips with it, making it slippery beneath my hand. I'm death himself, presiding over this butchery. Some of my victims die with merciful swiftness, gone before their bodies touch the ground. Others take longer. A wretched part of me wants to do it stealthily. Just slip up behind them and slide my sim in so I don't have to see their eyes. But the battle is uglier than that. Harder. Crueler. I stare into the faces of the men I kill. And though the storm muffles the groans, every death carves its way into my memory. Each one a wound that will never heal. Death supplants everything. Friendship, love, loyalty. The good memories I have of these men, of helpless laughter, of bets won and pranks hatched, they are stolen away. All I can remember are the worst things, the darkest things. Ennis, sobbing like a child in Helene's arms when his mother died 6 months back. His neck snaps in my hands like a twig. Leander and his never-to-be-requited love for Helene. My sim slides into his neck like a bird through a clear sky. Easily, effortlessly. Demetrius, who screamed in futile rage after he watched his 10-year-old brother whipped to death by the commandant for desertion. He smiles when he sees me coming, drops his weapon, and waits as if the edge of my blade is a gift. What does Demetrius see as the light leaves his eyes? His little brother waiting for him. An infinity of darkness. On goes the slaughter, and all the while, lurking in the back of my head, is Cain's ultimatum. The battle will end when you, Aspirant Vittorius, defeat, or are defeated by, the leader of the enemy. I've tried to seek out Helene and end this quickly, but she's elusive. When she finally finds me, I feel as if I've been battling for days, though in truth, it has been no more than half an hour.
Elias!
She shouts my name, but her voice is weak with reluctance. The battle slows to a halt as our men stop attacking each other, as the mist clears enough for them to turn and watch Helene and me. Slowly, they gather around us, forming a half-circle pocked by empty spaces where living men should stand. Hel and I face each other, and I wish for the augur's power to know her mind. Her blonde hair is a tangle of blood, mud, and ice, her braid unpinned and hanging limply down her back. Her chest rises and falls heavily. I wonder how many of my men she's killed. Her fist tightens around the hilt of her sim, a warning she knows I won't miss. Then she attacks. Though I pivot and bring up my sim to parry, my insides are paralyzed. I am staggered at her vehemence. Another part of me understands. She wants this madness done. At first, I try to deflect her, unwilling to go on the offensive. But a decade of ruthlessly honed instinct rebels at such passivity. Soon, I'm fighting in earnest, using every trick I know to survive her onslaught. My mind flickers to the attack poses Grandfather taught me, the ones the Blackcliff Centurions don't know, the ones Helene won't be able to defend against. You can't kill Hel. You can't! But what choice is there? One of us has to kill the other, or the trial won't end. Let her kill you. Let her win. As if she senses my weakness, Helene grits her teeth and drives me back, her pale eyes glacial, daring me to challenge her. Let her, let her, let her! Her sim cuts into my neck, and I counter with a quick thrust, just as she's about to take my head off. My battle rage rushes through me, shoving all other thoughts aside. Suddenly, she isn't Helene. She is an enemy who wants me dead, an enemy I must survive. I fling my sim to the sky, watching with mercenary satisfaction as Helene's eyes flick up to follow the weapon's path. Then I strike, coming down on her like an executioner. My knee drives into her chest, and even through the storm, I hear the crack of a rib and the surprised whoosh of her breath leaving her. She is beneath me, her ocean eyes terrified as I pin her sim arm down. Our bodies are entangled, entwined, but Helene is foreign to me suddenly, unknowable as the heavens. I tear a dagger from my chest, and my blood roars as my fingers touch the cold hilt. She knees me and grabs her sim, determined to finish me before I can finish her. I'm too fast. I lift the dagger high, my rage peaking,
holding like the highest note of a mountain storm. And then I bring the blade down.
Chapter 39. Liar. In the pre-dawn darkness, the storm churning above Sarah strikes with the wrath of a conquering army. The servants' corridor swims in a half-foot of rain, and Cook and I sweep out the water with rush brooms, while Izzy tirelessly stacks sandbags. Rain lashes my face like the icy fingers of a ghost. "Nasty day for a trial," Izzy calls to me over the downpour. I don't know what the third trial will be, and I don't care, except to hope that it serves as a distraction for the rest of the school while I look for a secret entrance into Blackcliff. No one else seems to share my indifference. In Sarah, bets over who will win border on the obscene. The odds, Izzy tells me, have shifted to favor Marcus instead of Veturius. Elias. I whisper his name to myself. I think of his face without the mask and the low, thrilling timbre of his voice when he whispered in my ear at the Moon Festival. I think of how he moved when he fought with Aquila. That sensual beauty that took my breath away. I think of his implacable anger when Marcus nearly killed me. Stop, liar. Stop. He's a mask, and I'm a slave, and thinking of him in this way is so wrong that I wonder for a second if the beating Marcus gave me has muddled my brain. Inside, slave girl. Cook takes my broom, her hair a wild halo in the storm. Commandant's calling. I rush upstairs, soaked through and shivering, to find the Commandant pacing her room with a violent energy, her blonde tresses unbound. My hair, the woman says when I dart into her chambers. Quickly, girl, or I'll have it out of your hide. The second I finish, she leaves the room, snatching her weapons from the wall, not bothering to give me her usual litany of orders. Sure, are they like a wolf on the hunt? Izzy says, when I enter the kitchen. Went straight for the amphitheatre. That must be where the trial is. I wonder. You and the rest of the schoolgirl, Cook says. We'll find out soon enough. We're stuck inside today. Commandant said any slave out on the grounds will be killed on sight. Izzy and I exchange a glance. Cook kept us up preparing for the storm until past midnight last night, and I'd been planning to look for a secret entrance today. It's not worth the risk, liar, Izzy warns me when Cook turns away. You still have tomorrow. Rest your mind for a day, and a solution might present itself. A rumble of thunder greets her comment. I sigh and nod. I hope she's right. Get to work, you two, Cook shoves a rag in Izzy's hand. Kitchen girl, you finish the silver, polish the banister, scrub the... Izzy rolls her eye and throws down the cloth. Dust the furniture, hang the laundry, I know. Let it wait, Cook. The Commandant's gone for an entire day. Can't we appreciate that? Even for a minute? Cook presses her lips together in disapproval, but Izzy assumes a wheedling tone. Tell us a story. Something scary. She shivers in anticipation, and Cook makes a strange sound that could be a laugh or a groan. Life isn't scary enough for you, girl. Quietly, I slip to the back of the kitchen work table to press the seemingly endless stack of the Commandant's uniforms. It's been ages since I've heard a good tale, and I long to get lost in one. But if Cook knows that, he'll probably keep silent on principle. The old woman appears to ignore us. Her hands, small and fine, sift through jars of spices as she prepares lunch. You won't give up, will you? I think at first that Cook is speaking to Izzy, only to look up and find her regarding me. You mean to see this mission to save your brother through to the end, no matter what the cost? I have to. I wait for her to launch into another of her rants against the resistance. But instead, she nods, unsurprised. I have a story for you, then, she says. It has no hero or heroine. It has no happy ending. But it's a story you need to hear. Izzy raises an eyebrow and takes up her polishing cloth. Cook shuts one spice jar and opens another. Then she begins.
Long ago, she says, when man knew not greed, malice, tribe, nor clan, jinn walked the earth.
Cook's voice is nothing like a tribal Kihani's. It is stern where a tail spinner's would be gentle, all edges where a tail spinner's would be mellow and curved. But the old woman's cadence reminds me of the tribe's people anyway, and I'm pulled into the tale.
Immortal, Ijimwa.
Cook's eyes are quiet, as if she's lost in an inner musing.
Created of sinless, smokeless fire. They rode the winds and read the stars, and their beauty was the beauty of the wild places. Though the jinn could manipulate the minds of lesser creatures, they were honorable and occupied themselves with the raising of their young and the protection of their mysteries. Some were fascinated by the untempered race of man. But the leader of the jinn, the king of no name, who was oldest and wisest of them, counseled his people to avoid men. So they did. As centuries passed, men grew strong. They befriended the race of wild elementals, the Afrits. In their innocence, the Afrits showed men the paths to greatness, granting them powers of healing and fighting, of swiftness and fortune-telling. Villages became cities. Cities rose into kingdoms. Kingdoms fell and were melded into empires. From this ever-changing world arose the empire of the scholars, strongest among men dedicated to their creed, through knowledge, transcendence. And who had more knowledge than the jinn, the oldest creatures of the earth? In an attempt to learn the secrets of the jinn, the scholars sent delegations to negotiate with the king of no name. They received a gentle but firm response. We are jinn. We are apart. But the scholars hadn't created an empire by giving up at the first rejection. They sent cunning messengers, raised to oration, the way masks are raised to walk. When that failed, they sent wise men and artists, spellcasters and politicians, teachers and healers, royalty and commoners. The response was the same. We are jinn, we are apart. Soon, hard times struck the scholar empire. Famine and plague took whole cities. Scholar ambition turned to bitterness. The scholar emperor grew angry, believing that if only his people had the knowledge of the jinn, they could rise again. He gathered the finest scholar minds into a coven and set them to one task. Mastery of the jinn. The coven found dark allies among the fae. Cave afrits, ghouls, wraiths. From these twisted creatures, the scholars learned to trap the jinn with salt and steel and summer rain still warm from the heavens. They tormented the old creatures, seeking the source of their power. But the jinn kept their secrets. Enraged at the evasion of the jinn, the coven no longer cared for fae secrets. They sought now only to destroy the jinn. Afrits, ghouls, and wraiths abandoned the scholars, understanding the full extent of man's thirst for power. Too late. The fae had given their knowledge freely and in trust, and the coven used that knowledge to create a weapon that would conquer the jinn forever. They called it the Star. The Fae watched in horror, desperate to stop the doom they helped unleash. But the Star gave the humans unnatural power, and so the lesser creatures fled, disappearing into the deep places to wait out the war. The jinn stood fast, but they were too few. The coven cornered them and used the Star to lock them forever in a grove of trees. A living, growing prison, the only place powerful enough to bind such creatures. The power unleashed by the jailing destroyed the Star and the coven. But the scholars rejoiced, for the jinn were defeated, all but the greatest of them. The king, Izzy says, Yes, the king of no name escaped imprisonment, but he had failed to save his people, and his failure drove him mad. It was a madness he carried with him like a cloud of ruin. Wherever he went, darkness fell, deeper than a midnight ocean. The king was at long last given a name. The Nightbringer. My head snaps up. My Lord Nightbringer. For hundreds of years, Cook says, the Nightbringer plagued mankind however he could. But it was never enough. Like rats, men scurried into their hiding places when he came, and like rats, they emerged as soon as he was gone. So he began to plan. He allied himself with the scholar's ancient enemy, the Marshals, a cruel people exiled to the northern reaches of the continent. He whispered to them the secrets of steelcraft and statecraft. He taught them to rise above their brutish roots. Then he waited. Within a few generations, the Marshals were ready. They unleashed the invasion. The Scholar Empire fell quickly, its people enslaved, broken, but still alive. And so the Nightbringer's thirst for revenge remains unquenched. He lives now in the shadows, where he lures and enslaves the lesser of his brethren, the ghouls, the wraiths, the cave of Fritz, to punish them for their betrayal so long ago. He watches, he waits, until the time is right, until he can exact his full revenge. As Cook's words die away, I realize I'm holding the press mid-air. Izzy gapes, a polishing forgotten. Lightning flashes outside, and a gust of wind rattles the windows and doors. Why do I need to know this story? I ask. You tell me, girl. I take a deep breath. Because it's true, isn't it? Cook smiles her twisted smile. You've seen the Commandant's nighttime visitor, I take it. Izzy looks between us. What visitor? He called himself the Nightbringer, I say. But it can't be. He's exactly what he says he is, Cook says. Scholars want to close their eyes to the truth. Ghouls, wraiths, wights, djinn. They're just stories. Tribal myths, campfire tales, such arrogance, she sneers. Such pride. Don't you make that mistake, girl. Open your eyes to it, or you'll end up like your mother. Nightbringer was right in front of her, and she never even knew it. I set the press down. What do you mean? Cook speaks quietly, as if she's afraid of her own words. He infiltrated the resistance, she says, took human form and proposed as a fighter. She clenches her jaw and huffs before going on. Got close to your mother, manipulated and used her. Cook pauses again, her face growing pinched and pale. Your father caught on. The Nightbringer had help. Traitor. Outwitted John and sold your parents to Gerris. No, I... Cook? Izzy jumps up as the old woman grabs her head with one hand and staggers back into the wall with a moan. Cook! Away! The older woman shoves Izzy in the chest, nearly knocking her to the floor. Get away! Izzy raises her hands, her voice pitched low as if she's speaking to a frightened animal. Cook, it's all right. Get to work! Cook draws herself upright, the brief quiet in her eyes shattered, replaced with something close to madness. Leave me be! Izzy pulls me from the kitchen hurriedly. She gets like that sometimes, she says, once we're out of earshot, when she talks about the past. What's her name, Izzy? She's never told me. I don't think she wants to remember it. Do you think it's true, what she said about the Nightbringer, and about your mother? I don't know. Why would the Nightbringer go after my parents? What did they ever do to him? But even as I ask the question, I know the answer. If the Nightbringer hates the scholars as much as Cook says,
then it's no wonder he sought to destroy the lioness and her lieutenant. Their movement was the only hope the scholars ever had. Is he